from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in our next hour, virtual reality made the headlines earlier this year when Facebook announced its plans to acquire Oculus VR, a company making virtual reality headsets. Industry experts say there could be an affordable headset on the market as early as next year. And we'll examine the current developments in VR and what this technology can achieve beyond gaming and entertainment. We'll also discuss potential drawbacks of this deeply immersive technology. That's all next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Virtual reality made the headlines earlier this year when Facebook announced its plan to acquire Oculus VR, a company making virtual reality headsets. Industry experts say there could be an affordable headset on the market as early as next year. And in this hour, we want to examine the current developments in virtual reality and what this technology can achieve beyond gaming and entertainment. And we're also going to discuss potential drawbacks. And this is a deeply immersive technology. In fact, I immersed myself into it earlier this morning. I tried out the Oculus Rift headset and saw a few examples of the virtual reality cinema that Jaunt is developing. We're going to talk to somebody from Jaunt in the course of the hour. You can actually watch a video of my experience online at kqed.org/forum. I was in a bike park seeing a lot of skateboarding. I was looking at the Golden Gate Bridge from many different angles, and I was at a couple of concerts. Much more pleasant to my ears and eyes of violin players, the other of a guy who, not my kind of music, let's put it that way. But anyway, it was really fascinating to sit down and be a part of that this morning. And for those of you who are thinking, what is virtual reality? It's actually just making the real appear in front of you virtually, often in real time. And it's something that's been done to a great extent by the Navy and by the military, but it's moving into so many different directions now, and we're going to talk about that in the course of this hour. And I want to also say that it may transform medicine, teaching, so many things that certainly transforming education. You can go now to virtual reality and take college tours, and it's changing architecture and design. And we're going to talk about all those changes as well as positives and negatives with our guest. Peter Rubin is here. He's senior editor of Wired, wrote the June cover story in Wired about virtual reality and Oculus. Welcome, Peter Rubin.
Hi there. Thanks to be here.
Good to have you. Also good to have Jeremy Bailenson, who is founding director of Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford University. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you, and also good to have Scott Brook with us by phone, Vice President of Content for Jaunt VR. That's the company developing hardware, software, and tools to enable cinematic virtual reality. Scott Brook, welcome to Forum. Good morning.
Hey, thank you very much for having us.
So glad to have you all, and there is also a link to Peter Rubin's article on our website, kqed.org. Let's talk with you, Peter, about, first of all, this Oculus deal. Let's talk about that. Facebook, a couple of billion dollars. Mark Zuckerberg says it's going to revolutionize social media. A lot of expectations identified with it. What does it mean to you as a journalist?
For me, it's interesting to see a technology emerge that has the potential to kind of transform how we exist with one another. You mentioned it kind of puts this new reality in front of you, where really more than that, it injects you into another reality. I mean, really, this is you put this on as you experienced this morning, Michael, and you are somewhere else. And what that does is pose a number of kind of hypothetical situations, whether it's just simply existing and talking to somebody in real time or experiencing something fantastic like a game or being in the middle of a movie. So, as much as we've seen most of our technological revolutions in the consumable world happen inside of a window, we're now being put through that window into the world that the window was a frame to. So this is kind of the first time that we're breaking those confines, which as a journalist is kind of a remarkable thing.
Well, it's pretty exciting stuff. I mean, I was reading about Blue Shark. You can actually get in a Navy destroyer. I was reading about the fact that you can be in the Syrian war. I don't know that I want to necessarily be there virtually or otherwise, but it can literally kind of teleport you or transport you into reality, but a reality that is not reality.
Absolutely. And it's, one of the first things that happens to you the first time you put it on is your brain almost ceases to remember the real space that you're in. You can put your hands out in front of you because this world that you're in has an obstacle in front of you. And in reality, if you're sitting in a conference room or you're sitting in a radio studio, your hands may brush a mic stand and you'll think, what was that? And then there's this shift where you have to kind of reassimilate the topology of the world that you're actually physically, corporeally within.
And you're also looking at something that is going to be popularized and going to be commercialized. We're already seeing that happen to a great degree. The gear is costing a lot less. I was reading about going to a drugstore and actually getting a magnifying glass for virtual reality goggles for, what, about $10? I mean, as we speak here, young people, for the most part, I suppose, turning this world into commerce and making it accessible to so many of us. And let me go to Jeremy Bailenson on this. Some concerns about this. I mean, the same kind of concerns we didn't necessarily expect or see with Great Vision when people would sit down in front of a computer and just stay in front of the computer. I mean, people are going to stay in virtual reality, perhaps?
Well, the thing about virtual reality is when you enter, it's a very intense and arousing experience. It's not as if you can be multitasking, sitting on your phone, driving, walking down the street. So one thing that's an opportunity but also a concern is what happens in the world where, say, Facebook feels like a frat party or online gambling feels like Las Vegas. What happens when entertainment feels so real that you can't tell it's not entertainment? And there's wonderful opportunities for this. We tend to focus on how to build applications to really help people communicate, to help them get educated. However, there are concerns about when people are spending, right now in the U.S., kids between the ages of 8 and 18 spend 8 hours a day consuming digital media. When it's such an immersive and intense experience, what does this do to the brain? What does this do to society? These are things we think about from an experimental standpoint in my lab.
We really don't know. I mean, I've often suggested on air here that maybe neural pathways are being changed in terms of kids looking at their smartphones and whatever. And by the way, you can do virtual reality with a smartphone. I mean, hasn't Google developed something where they can just put a cardboard box on your head or something?
Yeah, so Google's done this. A guy named Mark Bolus down at USC has innovated this for a long time. The phone has more pixels than most traditional head-mounted displays that I've been using for about 20 years. The phone also can track your head movements with an accelerometer. All you've got to do is split the screen of the phone, slide it into a housing, put it to your eyes, and it's basically a ViewMaster, for those of you that remember that technology, that updates as you turn your head and really gives you a window to a world. So now everybody can get virtual reality simply if you have a phone.
Talk about some of the downsides, but let's look at the positive sides, because you are somebody on the sidelines here who's been cheering the positive and more ameliorative effects that virtual reality can have, and I want our listeners to know about that. I mean, for example, and people may have read you recently writing about this in the local newspaper, but you were talking about things like seeing ocean acidification or what's happening to coral reefs, getting into the ocean and making people a lot more aware of the necessity of doing things not to make a greater carbon footprint, or making people aware just of the necessity for feeling greater empathy by being where people are suffering. All those kinds of things are really possible here.
We try to leverage what I call the catch-22 of virtual reality. The brain treats a virtual reality experience as real. We have not yet evolved to understand that this perceptual experience isn't real. However, we can break all the rules. We can break physics. We can fast forward time. We can change the rules of the social world. So what we do from an environmental standpoint is we put someone in a future that really is a disparate and accurate picture of what humans are doing to the planet, and then show them how their own behaviors, especially when it scales up in mass, are contributing to that problem. So this visceral experience, for example, we ran a study of if you use non-recycled toilet paper, which turns out is taken mostly from second growth forests and some virgin forest, you're basically cutting down two trees over the course of your lifetime. If I was trying to teach you that lesson, it'd be very counterproductive to bring you to the physical world and have you cut down two trees. That really wouldn't help deforestation. We have people cut down trees virtually. They put on the helmet. They look around the forest. We have a haptic device that shakes their hands. It really feels real. When the tree falls down, it crashes and thunders the floor. We then track their paper use in the physical world and show that people that cut down a virtual tree use 20% less paper than, say, someone who watched a video or read about cutting down a tree.
Now, you mentioned tracking. Actually, you're tracking movement and senses in all this. You're redrawing a scene. You're displaying a scene back about, what, 100 times a second, something
like that? Yeah, so virtual reality works like this. In the physical world, you're walking around. We've got sensors that track every step you take, every direction that you turn your head. 200 times a second at least. We then change what your eyes see because you're wearing a special helmet, what your ears hear because you've got an array of speakers that can spatialize sound, and sometimes what your skin feels with devices that can actually move your hands for you. So this cycle, move in the physical world, change what you see and send it back to the body, that repeats so often that you don't know that it's happening. It's what we call the illusion of non-mediation. We call this presence, and most people think that it's real. To give you an example, Michael.
You have your own jargon.
it's not my jargon. This field's been around for about 20 years, this idea of presence. But the demo that we do, when you come to the lab, Michael, you'll put on the helmet, you'll look around the room, and it'll look just like the room. We'll hit a button and the floor will drop. You'll see a 10-meter drop right in front of you. And one in three adults, when they see that, they refuse to even take a step towards this chasm that's in front of you.
It's that real. It's that imminent.
It's that real.
Yeah. I mean, it's fantastic stuff and extraordinary stuff. But at the same time, I'm afraid of people getting addicted to it and maybe desensitized the way they are now to porn and things like that. I mean, especially, I don't even know what this is going to do to sexuality in virtual reality.
I think about this all the time. And as much as I try to focus on pro-social effects, for example, we put you in a virtual reality and we take a white male and we put you in the mirror and we show you what you'd look like as a woman of color. And we use this for diversity training software. We build educational simulations where kids can get to experience diving underwater. But you're right. If men are addicted to pornography right now and it's 2D videos, when you have haptics, which is virtual touch, and you're immersed in a scene that feels like you're in a movie, how is that going to change the nature of how people think about entertainment? And
yeah, I'm afraid you're going to see a lot of people with headphones on all the time. I mean, you do now.
You see that now.
But of course, maybe even to a greater degree, the addictive side of this really has to be taken into the equation. Let me just go back, if I may, to you, Peter Rubin. We're about a year away from this, from everything I read, now being in our homes and all that. At least that's what some of the prognosticators are saying.
Yeah, I think an educated guess would be within about a year we're going to be seeing that first consumer version. And this is from Oculus, Oculus VR, which was a company from Southern California that has kind of been it looks like they're going to be first to market with this. A number of other companies have thrown their hat in the ring and are trying to develop their own consumer virtual reality headsets and displays, but it seems like Oculus has enough of a head start that they're going to be first. Oculus is just releasing now what's called a developer kit, and that is essentially a fully operational headset without some of the bells and whistles that they may introduce for the consumer version, but it's enough for people to use to program or develop content for this.
Well, one of the companies that has skin in this game, if you can talk about real skin or virtual skin, I'm not sure, is Jaunt. And Scott Brock is Vice President of Content for Jaunt VR. They're a company developing hardware, software, and tools to enable cinematic virtual realities. And Scott Brock, join us. Thanks for joining us. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
I experienced, thanks to some of your employees, some Jaunt virtual reality this morning, as I've said on the air here, and it's about as real as it gets. I'm interested to hear from listeners, in fact, what they would like to see beyond gaming and entertainment. But you're tied a lot to the film industry, or you're moving into the film industry in what ways?
Well, we certainly have, we have quite a bit of traction in Hollywood. But, you know, honestly, the technology, if you want to take a step back, what's really happening here is that we've really presented a way that you can capture the world in true three dimensions. It's we use a form of capture called computational photography, and certainly we don't have enough time to go into the technical details, but the long and short of it is that we're able to use multiple points of view to create a perfect sphere, one for your left eye and one for your right eye, and each sphere represents what your eye would normally see in the real world. And on top of that, you know, from this we can construct the world around you in a very believable, persistent way, and it's pushed out at 60 frames per second, which is, you know, tracks very well with your head wherever you look. But the thing that really cements it is not only the video, it's the audio. We capture in a very different way. We capture something called ambisonic audio, which is a complete sound sphere. And that has importance because the reflectivity of sound, the way we capture all the impulses from the real world are married together with this, you know, fairly very convincing representation of the world around you when you watch it back in a VR headset in a way that you're completely immersed.
Well, in fact, I'm sorry, but, it's not only what the eye sees or what is heard in the way of sound. It's also what the body is feeling and what's being
correct.
Experienced in the corporal sense. Like Jeremy said, you feel like you're going to step off something, and it really is vivid and real.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that, you know, you now just stepped into the real crux of it, that, you know, for a lot of people, entertainment does seem like the first, you know, the first step. The thing that would probably be the thing that hits mass, you know, pop culture and consciousness. I mean, so that's why, yes, we're doing things like making movies that you are a part of. You may have seen, you know, we did a test of science fiction where you're in the middle of a hallways where, you know, monsters are coming at you from different directions. And that, by the way, was just a test on a real set. But then we've also shot...
I didn't do that one. I was a little bit too timorous to do that.
Well, it's worth it. And but then we've directed and shot a movie with the new director of the new Paranormal Activity movie where you're in a 6.5-minute long horror movie. You're in the middle of it, and it takes place around you, and it acknowledges you as being part of this environment. And everything works to give you, works together to give you a sense of real being, like being there. But, you know, look, honestly, this is just more than entertainment. You know, you had talked about education. The convincing nature of being in a space that's persistent wherever you look in true three dimensions with true audio could work for education. I mean, a lot of online distance learning, there's usually a TA in the back of the room with a camcorder shakily trying to track the professor as he moves across the room. But this technology can actually give you the third row best seat in the house where you can watch the professor and say, like, it's or Harvard or MIT, and there's a Socratic method to it. As the teacher asks someone to your left, you'll turn around and you'll see that person in three dimensions, you know, in video. By the way, this is not a video game. This is a recording of real life.
Yeah, you're recording reality is what
yeah,
you're doing.
And that's an important point to make. You know, Jaunt is, we're leaving the video games to the video game folks, but you know, we are capturing wherever that camera is. It captures reality.
But didn't this start out for you guys in Death Valley? You were with Redpoint.
Well, no. So the founders, Tom and Al, Jens Christensen and Arthur Van Hoff, they were doing entrepreneurs in residence over at Redpoint. And at that time, one of them, Tom, had taken a trip, into the wild, and he was so overtaken by the grandeur of the place, he thought to himself, I could only find a way to capture this, not just in the 16:9 frame, you know, the restrictions that Peter was referring to, but where I could have a true recall of what it was like to stand here and to have this experience. And that gave rise to looking into the possibilities, and that, at the time, the Oculus Rift was still in its Kickstarter phase. One was bought off of eBay, and, you know, we built a prototype camera that proved that, you know, you could do computational photography to, you know, create these very convincing experiences. And from there, it was a very fast trip through funding and into development. And, you know, this past year, you know, the past 6 months have been somewhat of a rocket because the acquisition of Oculus by Facebook really created the environment where people understand now that this is, you know, not just a future technology, but it's happening, and it's very much happening right now.
Scott Brook with us by phone, Vice President of Content for Jaunt. Jaunt VR is a company developing hardware, software, and tools to enable cinematic virtual reality. Thank you for joining us, Scott. Good to have you with us on Forum. I want to go back to, some of the concerns as well as some of the exciting things about this brave new world that we're talking about. It's like we're moving into Matrix here, and it's happening with a great deal of alacrity. Let me go back to you, Jeremy Bailenson, on this. There was a lot of concern at first about this with motion sickness, and now you've pretty much vanquished that?
Motion sickness typically occurred because you'd move your head or your body, and the world would follow a little bit later due to either what's called latency or slow update rate. As long as you're drawing the screen at least 60 seconds in each eye and you're tracking movement accurately, you tend not to get that. Now, when you come to my lab, the first question we ask you before we make you walk the plank and cross this pit, we ask you if you're able to sit as a passenger in a car. So still, people that can't sit in a car are probably not going to enjoy being inside of virtual reality.
And if we could go back with you, Peter Rubin, to Oculus and this whole deal. I mean, they're working now with Samsung, I believe, and they're developing a headset, making this custom size with display units. I mean, that's all moving forward.
Yeah, so nothing has been officially announced or confirmed, but a number of leaks and some good reporting seems to have unearthed the idea that Oculus is helping Samsung develop a standalone virtual reality headset into which a person would slide their Samsung smartphone, like Jeremy was talking about, in return for which Samsung will create custom-sized displays for Oculus's own Rift headset. So as you can imagine, there are some pretty particular needs for an optimized virtual reality headset, from dimensions to pixel density to refresh rate and all sorts of other things.
And Sony's perfecting one too.
Sony's been working on one that they are – right now it's only called Project Morpheus. We only know it by its code name. There's still a little bit of fog enshrouding it.
Morpheus or Amorpheus? No, I mean, it is kind of shrouded, like you
it
said.
Is.
It's amorphous.
I mean,
yeah.
People have gotten to see it at gaming trade shows, and they have it at Sony's headquarters in Foster City down on the peninsula. But there's no timetable for release or for price point or any of those things.
And we're talking about the positive side of this, Jeremy Balanson. I understand there's talk about using this with soldiers overcoming PTS.
There's so one of the great strengths of using virtual reality is to help people get better in lots of ways. So Skip Rizzo down at USC has for over a decade put soldiers back in virtual Iraq to help them get over their fears. We do work with a medical school at Stanford to help kids who've got chronic regional pain syndrome, this horrible neurological disorder where you can't move your arms, but the way to get better is to move your arms. And so what we do is we put kids in avatars where when they move their arm, you know, 10 degrees at the elbow, they see their avatar move 30 degrees. So they get this empowerment, this sense of a gain factor, for lack of a better word, where their avatar's arm works better than their physical arm, and they slowly are starting to get better by doing this. So a lot of work in medicine to use virtual reality to help people get better.
Okay. I think we've outlined a good deal of what certainly some of the exciting and new vistas are for virtual reality. It's being used a lot in surgery, too, in fact, Jeremy. Yeah.
Surgery for the last 20, 30 years, a lot of work to help surgeons learn how to use these tools that have got strange angles and to see how it turns just in the sense of training. But now in terms of having doctors from far away control a robot that gives you surgery, I think we call this teleoperation, certainly a very successful area.
Being used in everything, as we said earlier, tourism, travel, architecture, design, you name it.
Well, the home run for me is travel. If we can stop people from having to fly across the world for a one-hour meeting, think of the carbon footprint that we're going to save.
You can also take a field trip, I understand, to Rome, past, present, and future.
That's right.
You can be in Rome in the past, ancient Rome. You can be in – I mean, it's all very exciting. But there are the downsides and the darker sides. And I'd like to hear from some of you. If you've had any experience with virtual reality, what's it been like? What's it like in your mind in terms of beyond entertainment and gaming and all these good uses? But what about your worries and concerns about where it's headed? I'd like to hear from listeners on all of those scores. And you can join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls and your involvement in the program. So, again, feel free to join us now. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. Your thoughts about virtual reality, your positive thoughts or your concerns and worries and anxiety. And by the way, you're going to be able to buy a virtual reality headset when they could become available, presumably at a reasonable cost. We're talking with Jeremy Balanson. He's here with us in studio. He's a founding director of Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford University, a leading virtual reality lab. Peter Rubin, also with us, a senior editor of Wired. He wrote the June cover story in Wired about virtual reality and Oculus. And we spoke with Scott Brook, who is vice president of content for Janus VR. And I experienced that. I'm getting words in my headset. A Jaunt VR. I said Janus. Isn't that interesting as a Freudian slip? I mean, you're the psychologist. Why do I want to see Janus? Because it's two-headed, because we're talking about something that's two-headed. Jaunt VR. Thank you. And I saw them, and you can see what I saw simply by going to our website, kqed.org. I put on the Oculus Rift headset, saw a few examples of the reality cinema, virtual reality cinema that Jaunt is developing. Feel free to join us. You can tweet us. Our Twitter handle's at KQED Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about virtual reality this hour, and as I said earlier this morning, I tried out the Oculus Rift headset and saw a few examples of the VR cinema that Jaunt is developing. We talked to their VP in the previous part of this hour, and you can experience this online at kqed.org/forum, and you can also join us in this hour if you have comments you'd like to add or questions you might have by going to our online going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. You can also join us by tweeting us. And here's a Twitter a tweet from Johnny who writes, I'm an avid gamer and arts fan and blind in one eye since birth. Is this tech going to leave me behind the way 3D films do? Jeremy Bailenson?
So we do work on what we call immersion, where if you imagine virtual reality is actually it's a set of things. It's mono stereo vision. It's tracking your head movements. It's having a high field of view. It's a latency. It's update rate. And you can actually pick apart all of the components. And we do a lot of work where you run experiments where you vary all of those. And good news for our listener, mono stereo, having the ability to see stereoscopically, is actually one of the cues that matters least. So if you're tracking someone's head movements and you're giving them a high field of view with a low update rate, it's still going to feel really neat for you.
All right. I want to go to our callers. But first, Peter Rubin, an email here from Patrick who says, because smartphones play a very important role significantly in what's up for the future here. And Patrick writes, there are 1.75 billion smartphones in use today, and they can be turned into virtual reality devices. If this is the next media transition and it has reached commercial mass market viability by the end of 2015, we should see 50 million VR devices in the world. Radio took 38 years to reach 50 million, TV 14 years. I love the way my listeners sometimes, you know, get into these kind of codifying of things. The Internet, 4 years. Each happened three times faster than the previous one. We're talking about like Moore's Law here. Okay. What do the guests think the adoption curve will look like for this technology, Peter?
I think it's a little bit slower than the 4 years we're talking about. I mean, what's going to happen first is there's going to be an at-home consumer unit. This is going to be the first thing that is going to give people a true sense of presence, which is this sense Jeremy was talking about. And then after that, the next move is certainly going to be to these standalone, lightweight mobile headsets, whether that's using a smartphone as your screen or something that's really optimized to create true immersion. With a phone, it's going to be good, but it's not. There's going to be holes in this. This is not going to be an ironclad virtual reality experience.
We're talking about really a bifurcation of technology here in terms of the experience itself. Really.
Certainly. Yeah. And I think we've seen the same thing as smartphones hit the market and people who were using flip phones or, as we call them, dumb phones, you know, a furrow deepened there. And eventually, as smartphones cheapened and parts came to market that made this possible, you saw more and more people come over. That's the same thing that's going to happen as VR becomes lighter weight, cheaper, and better quality.
All right. We'll go to our callers, and let's begin with Shannon. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Yes, speak to us.
Oh, sorry. I saw the Oculus exhibit at Maker's Faire this year, and we waited like an hour and a half because we were all gamers and pretty interested in this, and we're really disappointed. And it doesn't sound anything like what you guys were talking about this morning, so I was wondering if you're talking about the same thing that you guys were showing at Maker Faire, because what we saw was where you stick your head in a box, and the first display was just an inanimate object that was kind of floating there, and the second one was when you stick your head in a box and people were sort of chasing you, but there was no you, and it felt very like clunky and not immersive at all, and certainly not something I would consider, you know, ready to come to market in the next year.
That's not what we're talking about, is it, Peter Rubin?
No, I mean, certainly people could have been using an early version of the Oculus dev kit, what's called the DK1, and I don't know what that demo was that you saw or who created it.
It was Oculus.
Oculus created it. I'm unfamiliar.
It was Oculus's display.
No, it was their display, but I mean, was it their demo? Because there's been a progression certainly over the past 2 years in both what the development kits have been able to do and what experiences have been created for it. To give you an example, the Oculus has been used throughout this past year to do an installation that basically took people up the giant ice wall from Game of Thrones. They debuted this at South by Southwest earlier this year. It had lines around the block. This is the kind of thing that they brought to Comic-Con. And, you know, having experienced it and having talked to a number of people, there certainly wasn't that same disappointment. I do think that there's something that you mentioned about there was no you there. When you're a disembodied first-person perspective in a virtual world, that's going to happen. One of the solutions around that is most easily done in gaming, and that is to make the character you're playing in a game be somewhat stationary. For example, you are a dogfighting pilot in a spaceship. You can look down and see your hands and your legs, but because you yourself are in a stationary environment, that's going to matter to you less, and that's not going to break the illusion of presence. Meanwhile, all the action is happening outside the confines of your spaceship, so you can actually be in there in a way that makes you feel and even look down and see yourself, but it's not going to inhibit any of the entertainment value of what you're talking about.
Let me thank Shannon for the call, but just a quick footnote here before I go to more callers with you, Peter, and that is, again, let's talk about the split. I mean, Oculus is talking. We're talking headsets when we're talking about Oculus,
that's
as opposed
correct.
To Google or Samsung, where you're using your phone and mm-hmm. you're using it essentially for mobile purposes of VR.
That's correct. The Oculus the Rift is really the name of the headset, the Oculus Rift. So this is the thing that's going to be coming to market sometime in the next year, most likely. This is meant for at-home use. It is essentially it's a peripheral to use with your computer, whether that is a high-powered laptop or a dedicated gaming PC. This isn't something that's going to work with your TV. This isn't something that in this first iteration is going to work by itself. They are moving towards that as mobile chips, system-on-a-chips as they're known. Get more and more powerful, then you can have all the processing power you need on board a very lightweight set of goggles.
Well, so, she might not have had the Rift. She might have had something.
She may have had the Rift, but she may have had kind of a dated experience and using a dated development kit. And certainly the first prototype, the DK1, as I mentioned, it had higher latency, so it was much more probable that some simulator sickness could have arisen and the lower resolution display. So there are a couple of factors that could have made it a less than ideal experience.
Well, let me get to more callers. And Dawn joins us. Dawn, you're on.
Hi. I am so excited about this whole idea, and I'm envisioning the future being on a holodeck like in Star Trek. But I have an educational question. So my son spent his entire high school years playing World of Warcraft, and so I do have the concern that young people will have this on, and as you guys have already talked, just kind of be in a virtual world. Is there a way to be able to do retinal identification and so that it will lock the player out after an hour or two and not allow them back on for a day or something like that?
I would say if we're worried about kids gaming too much, then it's the same controls that exist for World of Warcraft, which is, we as guardians and parents get to stop that. As for retinal identification, Jeremy, I'm going to defer to you on this one.
Yeah, Jeremy Bailenson.
Well, the neat thing about VR is that you don't need retinal identification because you can use what we call the digital footprint. So lots of companies are looking at how you move your head, how we track your movement. And it turns out the way you simply move your body, which is automatically tracked by all virtual reality systems, is enough to identify who you are and, for example, how long you've been playing a game. So the Microsoft Kinect, which tracks 24 points on your body, the XYZ position of each point, we've run studies in my lab that show that you can detect not only who someone is, but their state of mind, whether they're learning, what they're doing, if they're gaming or not, simply by how the body moves.
Jeremy, there's a lot more in this technology that has to forge forward. I mean, particularly if it goes to mass market. I mean, that's really what we're talking about, at least at this juncture. And, I mean, high res was mentioned before, high resolution. You got the necessity of high refresh rates, of fast processors. I mean, all of this is somewhat more distant. It's all necessary, though.
The thing to remember is that virtual reality has been around for a long time. What we're seeing now for the first time is it's getting to the consumer market for a couple of $100. But you can, for example, if you come to my lab, we've got a head-mounted display by a company called NVIS that is, higher resolution, higher field of view. It's, almost 100 times the price of the Oculus Rift. But it gives you all of these experiences that produce what we call immersion. And this has been around for a long time at this point. So there's really nothing new technologically other than the fact that this is very cheap for the consumer market. And psychologists and engineers, we've been studying this for decades.
You said that there isn't as much concern anymore about motion sickness except for people who need Dramamine when they're in a car or something along those lines. But I'm looking at a comment one of our listeners, Alan, wrote on Facebook. He says, the biggest issue for me is motion sickness. It can so easily result. Motion sickness occurs because movement is too fast. They need to slow it down, not speed it up. Also, initial tech is displaying half the pixels to each eye you could get from good monitor. All the immersion they have been describing can be done with a virtual camera in a virtual world, movement on a flat monitor. VR headsets improve this when combined with body monitoring like a treadmill.
So people, let me be clear. If motion sickness occurs when you dissociate what's called optic flow from vestibular cues. And those are fancy words. What you see should be happening in accordance with how your body moves. The problem with most people that have the Oculus Rift is they're not tracking your body movements so that you can't walk. So the one of the more famous demos that people watch on the Rift is this roller coaster. And the roller coaster is moving by very quickly, but your body isn't moving with it. You're not getting the vestibular cues from your inner ear. You're not getting the proprioceptive cues from your muscles as they slam the back of your seat. And so you're getting this dissociation between what the eyes see and what the body feels. When you're in good virtual reality, we're actually tracking how your body moves. So as you walk around the physical room, we're changing the world accordingly, and you don't get this discordance.
And we'll get some more callers on. We go to Nate next. Nate, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi there. My name is Nate. I'm from San Francisco. I work in technology, and I've actually had a pretty incredible experience with Oculus, and I've tried it, and it's very real. I guess really my
ditto from your host here, Nate. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. You know, just to follow on from the last question, which is, I understand a lot of these very important use cases in terms of education, in terms of medicine. But as a society, we can already see, I mean, the iPhone wasn't invented, you know, more than 10 years ago. And we can already see how addicted people are to this platform. I mean, what's going to happen to us is just from a culture and society standpoint, when we start to, you know, create experiences that mimic travel so you never have to go anywhere. Or that would, you know, mimic any type of experience so that you wouldn't have to experience anything outside of the virtual reality. Where does that blurred line start to actually become definitive, you know, for us as just a culture and society?
You're raising, I think, a very fundamental question. I mean, George Wallace, for those of you who remember that name, one time a presidential candidate, former governor of Alabama, you say, I don't need to go to Europe. I can see it on film. But there's still people who are going to want to experience. We had the co-founder of Lonely Planet on yesterday, and the idea of walking around and visiting and seeing things in that way. But there are people who will probably use this as a substitute constantly, feel I don't need to travel anymore, right?
Well, we have some data on this now. So a study out of the University of Michigan, people in the United States, kids, are getting their driver's licenses about 6 months later on average than we did 10 years ago. And this is actually a trend that's not only in the United States. Because the internet gives you symbolic freedom, you don't need to drive anymore. So, again, as these experiences get more immersive and going to...
You got automatic cars now, right? That too.
But do you need an automatic car where you can bring the party to you? And again, as I run a virtual reality lab and
I was just thinking about driver's license being necessary. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's right. No, we don't have those yet. Do you need to leave your house? And this is things that we study and we worry about. We ran a study with 7-year-olds, and we brought 7-year-olds into the lab, and we built their avatars so it looked just like them. They saw themselves from the third person swimming with whales. So a kid put on the helmet, and he saw himself swimming with Fudgy the whale. We brought the same kids back a week later, and 50% of the kids had formed what we call false memories, meaning they truly believed they had been to SeaWorld and physically swam around with a whale. For those kids, that virtual experience was real, and it changed their memory. And so we also think about the negative consequences of this. And as a lab, we see our mission is to really, you know, to be supporters of these good applications, but to be very honest about there are negative consequences, and we need to monitor them constantly.
Well, let me read you an email from one of our listeners who gets into honing some of these negative consequences. This is Rick in Palo Alto who writes, after watching two very intelligent teen boys play rather boring computer games, sometimes 18 hours at a stint, and with the knowledge that pornography makes up a very large fraction of internet bandwidth usage, sort of games, of course, one could imagine a dystopia where virtual sex could displace relationships, test tube babies, normal families. It seems almost certain that some large fraction of American citizens will be seduced by this type of technology.
Well, this has been a predominant motif in science fiction for as long as virtual reality has been conceived of by us. I mean, this is the dystopian side, right?
For every Brave New World.
For every pro, there's a con. And certainly any tool that can be used to brainwash a society, any tool that can be used to make people abusively disconnect from what we think of as real life can also be used to optimize it, to forge bonds where they couldn't before.
Peter, it was true of television, it was true of the internet, and now it's true of VR.
Yeah. Yeah, we were sad when people stopped bowling.
Maybe that's
leagues.
Why Janus was coming to my mind rather than Jaunt.
Well, during the last break, I actually trademarked that. So now Janus Virtual Reality is all mine.
Ah, okay. Glad to have it yours. And let's have another caller. Nance, join us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, I'd like to you said you'd be able to immerse yourself in, like, video games. Well, I know in the video game Pac-Play, if I'm using my keyboard to swing a sword or attack or run, is this going to be like Wii where you have to move your arms? Because you said you can't see outside the game. I can't see the keyboard. How will you be attacking? How will you be using your tools?
So there are two solutions for this. The first one, and the one that's kind of become the default throughout the development span of the Oculus Rift, is using an Xbox controller. It's essentially a game controller that you hold in your hands. It has a directional thumbstick. It has four buttons. It's very easy to map. You only use maybe one button and one thumbstick, and it's a very simplified control scheme. So that's one thing. You don't need your hands to do it. The other thing is that these companies are also working on input solutions, which are going to be a combination of a control scheme that people are already familiar with, maybe one that's button-driven, with one that's haptic-controlled, as Jeremy mentioned, that's going to involve both both motion tracking and some sort of force feedback to your hands. What that's going to look like, I'm not sure of. I have my pet theories of what we'd be looking at, which is some sort of a hybrid device. But while we're not going to have these full body haptic suits like we saw in movies like Lawnmower Man, we are going to have some sort of manual input device that allows you to do things like swing a sword and break through that metaphorical divide that we became accustomed to as PC gamers, which is a directional key and a space bar to jump or what have you. We became very used to these mediation layers, and we're going to be breaking through those. So it's not going to be – it's not necessarily going to be a Wiimote like the Nintendo Wii had, but there certainly are peripheral solutions and input solutions that people have hacked together that involve very, very similar motion control devices.
And again, Peter Rubin is senior editor of Wired and wrote the June cover story in Wired about virtual reality and Oculus. Let me read some of your comments here. Trace writes, the idea that virtual reality could limit the amount of plane travel and reduce carbon pollution is brilliant. Are there other non-entertainment uses for VR? For example, would VR be able to be used to experience what it is like for demonstrating citizens in Ferguson County, Missouri, or Yazidi Kurdish refugees? This might be a groundbreaking way to teach empathy and raise awareness. Well, that's in your pocket, isn't it, in many ways, Jeremy?
So we worked with a woman named Barbara Allen. She's a reporter for NPR. We built a version of Hurricane Katrina where you're in virtual reality and you look down and you're on this rooftop and the levee breaks and you hear this boom and then the water rises and it's getting higher up and then you hear these helicopters come over your head. They stop and hover by you and then they leave you and abandon you. The idea was to really get people who are news consumers to understand what it was like for the U.S. government to completely leave people to die on these rooftops and to really teach you about empathy. A lot of our work is about putting someone in a virtual experience to change the way they think, to make them more compassionate to others.
Well, some more positive remarks here online from a listener named Rekha, who says, I'm really excited for this technology. I'm a dancer, and I'm excited at the possibility that I may be able to dance at my level with my current abilities and performance level using virtual reality in another 20 years when my physical body doesn't keep up anymore. Wondering what kind of world that may be, and how soon will such applications be applicable?
That's a question for all the people that are developing content and experiences for this platform. I mean, we are really as long as people have been researching this, as long as virtual reality has been in a laboratory setting, it's really only leapt out in any real way over the past 3 years. I mean, certainly there have been consumer virtual reality headsets for well over a decade, but none of them delivered on what you really needed for presence. Now that is coming, we're just at the infancy of this thing. So in 20 years, is it possible? Absolutely. In 20 years, just about anything's possible. But there will certainly need to be a visual language that's learned by people who are creating these things. What is it like to be in a movie and then have it cut? You can't have cuts in a virtual reality movie. You can't just have a take that's all of a sudden a reverse angle. Imagine how disorienting that would be. We're learning a new language of both game developing and filmmaking, as well as almost any other consumable visual thing that's going to need to cater to the demands and the constraints of the platform we're talking about.
And if you'd like to join us in the time remaining, toll-free number is 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Here's an email from Nick who writes, I can already predict that there will be a lot of why do we need virtual reality when we already have actual reality questions, and I used to share the skepticism. This year at San Diego Comic-Con, there were several Oculus Rift setups, and I got a chance to use one. As soon as I put it on, my skepticism melted. Video games are the obvious media focus, but honestly, as much as I love games, they're the least of the possibilities here. Movies and concerts could potentially be revolutionized with this technology, even something as simple as tourism. I can't afford a ticket to Paris, let alone hotel, admission to museums and tourist sites and food, but I may be able to afford an Oculus once they come down in price. Would I rather walk through the Louvre? Yes, of course, but for those of us in the ever-expanding lower middle class, that's not a possibility right now. Gentlemen, want to say something about affordability, Peter?
Sure. Through two developer-focused iterations of the Oculus Rift, it went from $300 to $350. At this point, with a giant multi-billion-dollar infusion that they got from the Facebook acquisition, it allows them to keep that price point while making the internal componentry as strong as they possibly can. To put it in a very pat way, the people at Oculus VR had a wish list of everything they wanted to be able to put into the first consumer headset.
They said this will allow them to experiment in ways
exactly.
They hadn't imagined possible.
They're able to do that now, and what they're saying is we're looking at around the same price. So what I would venture to guess is that we're looking at around the $350 price point, but certainly in league with a standalone game console like an Xbox or a PlayStation.
Let me go to a tweet here from Craig, if I may, to you, Jeremy Bailenson. Craig writes or tweets, "It is important to discuss the impact of mobile VR as it will deliver the next million VR experiences while we wait."
Well, all VR can be mobile. It's by its very nature, it mentally transports you to another spot. So, again, I think stressing out too much about the hardware is not the way to think here. You've got the big players, Google, Microsoft, Samsung, Sony, and now Facebook, all competing to bring this to market. And in fact, some of these companies, from my conversations with them, they're trying to skip the headset altogether. So there is a world where you can bend light and produce hologram-like experiences where you don't even need a helmet. And some of the big companies are skipping the headset process to try to bring that to you. So I think what we should focus on is how can we create applications and content for VR that's going to make the world a better place. And, the hardware is going to follow that. But let's think about what to actually put in there.
I keep thinking, as you can tell, about Brave New World, Huxley's Brave New World. But I've got a listener here who says, anybody know The Velt by Ray Bradbury, virtual reality taken to an extreme? Are you familiar with it? It's actually a story about a couple of kids who use a virtual reality room to turn their imaginative ideas into reality, and by one of our great science fiction writers. Let me get another caller on here, and Lena joins us from Pinole. Lena, hi.
Hi. I was wondering how this usage of virtual reality, if that becomes the trend, how that affects how much exercise we get, the obesity problem. Does that exacerbate the obesity problem for youth and for adults? Because we just don't have, we can experience things that feel real, like going to Yosemite or that kind of thing. And we no longer use our muscles.
That's a very interesting point you're making, Lena. You can be in an exercise room or a yoga place, but not necessarily doing it, right?
So we build applications. We're actually working with a lot of weight loss companies right now to use virtual reality to transform the self. Imagine you were exercising in place, wearing the helmet. You saw yourself in a virtual mirror, and you were actually losing weight in the mirror as a function of your physical movement. So by running in place, every minute you ran, you saw your avatar, which looks just like you, losing weight. You get an exaggerated sense of cause and effect and build what's called self-efficacy. For about 10 years, we've been running experiments that show that in virtual reality, transforming the self causes people to exercise more in the physical world more than just about anything else people have tried.
Well, let me thank the caller. And another tweet, listener tweets, I would give and pay anything to use Oculus Rift to play with my dog Pavlov, who just passed away. Sean writes, what is in VR for someone who isn't interested in the latest and neatest new whiz-bang thing to come? Is there some application for a sports fan, baseball and football, which will enhance understanding of the game? And what can be done to avoid the horrendous knee-jerk hatred of the Google glass holes if I were to wear one out in public?
So we're building with Coach Shaw of the Stanford Cardinal – a simulator where you can experience what it's like to be Kevin Hogan of the Stanford football team. And we've actually built about 15 plays where, as a fan, instead of sitting on the 50-yard line, you can literally become Kevin Hogan. And in fact, Kevin is actually practicing by putting on the helmet and reliving plays by looking at different parts of the field and learning how to pick up different defenses. So the sports application is not only one that many people are thinking about, but one that we're building in my lab. It's a lot of fun.
And if I could speak to the social stigma for 1 second, I think the glass hole phenomenon that we're talking about, it gives us an opportunity to talk about these competing technologies. There's virtual reality and then there's augmented reality, or AR. And what Google Glass does, it's this layer between you and the world that, as Jeremy was, I think, alluding to when he talked about holographic technology, it is you're putting something between you and life. You're not putting yourself into a different existence. So virtual reality, by its very nature, necessitates that you not be in society with it. You can be in society within the headset, but as far as walking around, unless there's a pass-through camera, you're going to be a hazard to yourself and others. So I think from the very beginning, there's kind of a never the twain shall meet between AR and VR. So virtual reality is going to be the type of experience that, even though you can use your smartphone with it, it's going to necessitate maybe a little bit more isolation or at least immobility.
Well, we've got a emailer here who wants to know if Facebook's going to be doing product placement, a Coke can on the beach. I mean, it really does raise so many questions. But here's an online comment from a listener named Todd who says, "You can't protect nature and the earth unless you know it. Putting your head in a box is not knowing nature. So please don't tell us this gizmo is going to do anything for the destruction of habitats, mass extinction of species, et cetera, et cetera."
So my counter argument is, think about how many people drive to the Yosemite Valley. They do this long drive. They burn fossil fuels. They go to the same spot. They take the same pictures. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people each week over the summer. And the experience they're getting is simply standing around, looking, rotating. This is not experiencing nature yet. That's really destroying lots of parts of our parks, lots of human impact, lots of carbon footprint. We shouldn't replace nature. I don't have a Facebook account. I don't play video games. I run a VR lab because I want to build applications to change behavior. And there is a time and a place for a virtual replacement, and there's a time and a place to go outside.
Good place to end. Thank you, Jeremy Bailenson, founding director of Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford. Thanks, too, to Peter Rubin, who is here with us in studio as well, senior editor of Wired, who wrote the June cover story in Wired about virtual reality in Oculus. And thanks to Scott Brook, who joined us earlier, vice president of content for Jaunt VR. That's not Janus VR. Thanks also to Rob Spate and Danny Bringer, Danny Bringer, who's with me almost every day here, and Rob Spade, who filled in for him the last part of this hour. Also, thanks to our producers, Suki Lewis and Leslie Chang were very involved in this program and today's programs. Forums also produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. We get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.